Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Penchassi. My guest today is Lindsay Krasnoff, the author of The Making of Les Bleus, Sport in France, 1958 to 2010. The book was published by Lexington Books in 2013. Hi there, Lindsay.
Hi, Roxane. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you very much for having me on. I'm very excited to talk shop and talk about the book.
I wonder if you could get us started by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in working on France.
Sure, certainly. And just as a general disclaimer for everything I do or say in public or print, I do note that everything that we'll talk about here and that is published in the book reflects my own work as a scholar and does not reflect any views of the U.S. government or the Department of State, and that all the information I obtained was available through publicly available declassified information. But my interest in France and in French sport goes back many, many years. It's really difficult to pinpoint the exact point in time, but I think it even dates to my childhood when my parents left me at home when they went for a vacation to France, to Paris. And I guess I was really fascinated with this place called Paris and this place called France where they went and how it must be really great to leave me at home. So they come back and they bring books and they talk about the Tour Eiffel and so forth. And I think that initially really kind of sparked my interest in the country. And as I grew, deciding to take French in school and learn more about the country through history and geography, that kind of whetted my appetite even more to try to understand a very different culture. And, you know, there's a lot of French-American comparisons that go on all the time, whether in academia or in the regular press and American culture. So trying to figure out exactly where some of these comparisons stem from and understand the why behind it. The sports aspect actually comes into play. Once upon a time, I actually did want to be a sports journalist, and I did my journalism training in New York, and I did a joint program with journalism and French studies at NYU. And one of the requirements to graduate was to write a series of in-depth articles. For me, it would have to deal with France, but since I was also on the sports reporting track, it would have to deal with sports. So This was in the early 2000s, and this was at the height of French football in recent memory. And so it made sense that I worked on French football, or soccer, and sometimes I go back and forth between the terminology, but it refers to the same sport. My advisor at the time, Herrick Chapman, he had both of his daughters were very heavily involved in youth soccer. And so when we were tossing around ideas of what I could look into in terms of French sport and French soccer, he said, well, you know, they just won all these competitions, the World Cup, the European Championship, the Confederations Cup. How do they create these players, or how do they train players? Do they have the same type of youth system as we have here in the United States? If not, how does it differ? And so that kind of launched me into looking at the status of youth soccer training in France in the early 2000s, which is altogether kind of, it's its own little beast, as it were, for better or for worse. When I went back for my history degree, for history programs, you're always advised, find a topic that you can be married to for the next 7 years. Mm-hmm. And probably, you'll probably still want to divorce it at the end. But so I thought back to this investigation into youth soccer training in France that I had done a few years previously. And I thought, well, I know how the system operates in the 2000s, but how did it get there? France is not a country renowned for its sports culture. So I thought it would be a great historical examination of the topic. And the further I dug into the material, the more it led me to the government and policy aspect of the material.
Mm-hmm. And now, Lindsay, you work for the U.S. government, is that right? That might explain the disclaimer that you gave at the beginning.
Yes,
so what is your position? What do you do?
Right. I serve as a historian for the U.S. Department of State. I work in the office of the historian. There's about, I think, roughly 45 of us tucked away in Foggy Bottom. And the majority of our office works in some way, shape, or fashion on compiling, producing, and publishing the Foreign Relations of the United States series. It's the official documentary history of U.S. foreign policy. But I actually work, I'm one of the few who work in the internal support divisions. So I do a lot of special projects, longer-term internal historical support for the department. And so within that, I run a history briefing program for Foreign Service officers and ambassadors and other department and U.S. government personnel working with or posted to our posts in Europe. And I focus mostly on Western Europe to try to limit. There's only one of me, and there's a lot of Europe to cover.
Right. It's fascinating. I mean, when I found out more about, you know, your background and where you're working, I wondered about that, you know, whether being a historian of France gives you a particular perspective on the work that you do.
It does. And it's you know, and one of the perennial issues that comes up in U.S. popular culture or U.S. media is always the French-American relationship and trying to, it's really interesting how that's perceived internally as well. But naturally, I do a lot of work with our people in France or who work with our people in France. And I think there's a lot of interesting stuff that we do on that end, but also it's been really fascinating kind of branching out and covering the rest of Western Europe. A lot of, or at least in my PhD program as a Europeanist, we didn't necessarily tackle, you know, the history of the Benelux countries, Luxembourg, especially, you know, trying to answer questions about U.S. relations with Luxembourg has been, it's been kind of fun and challenging because there's so little out there and it's required a lot more archival work than one would think. But so yeah, there's very much that ability to kind of help expand on my knowledge base of France.
Well, let's talk about the making of Les Bleus then. You begin the book, Lindsay, by identifying your concern with the question of, and I'm quoting you here, how and why sport became an affair of state in France. So while the focus of the book is on the period from 1958 on, right up to 2010, you do outline a longer term history of preoccupations with physical fitness and education in France. So could you say a little bit about the history of sport in France before 1958?
Yeah, I think it's important to make a distinction between sport and physical education.
Oh, okay.
Because so sport, as it appears, is kind of refers much more to modern competitions, team sports, team competitions, whereas physical education has a much longer track record within France in terms of government support of the elites. Physical education is more kind of what you would think of in terms of gymnastics, calisthenics, drills, stretches, that sort of thing. Whereas I guess sport would be much more active, like football or basketball or fencing or the like. And so I think that's an important distinction to make. So there is, as the book traces, kind of a longer term trend of physical education as being interwoven in either French education in terms of helping to, you know, a healthy mind needs to be supported by a healthy body, or in terms of the military and the state, particularly in the 19th century, with the idea that we need to create not only Frenchmen, but fit Frenchmen to serve in the military, especially with mandatory military service. Particularly after the loss in 1870 during the Franco-Prussian War. Similarly, need to have, you know, strong, healthy girls so that they can procreate and help populate the nation. Kind of a little bit of that thinking in terms of why physical education was integrated into the school equation when it was promoted. Sports is slightly different. Sports has always been seen as more of a leisure time or a pastime activity. Sports in the late 19th century, so modern sports as we're familiar with them, really originate, are brought over in many instances from England or the United States, in the case of basketball, by the elites and the bourgeoisie, and then gradually trickle down so that they become more sports of the masses, particularly football. Thus, I think it's important to kind of keep that distinction in place. There's not the same room for sport within French education system or the school day as there is, say, for example, here in the United States or Great Britain, where it's a little bit more integrated.
Hmm, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. You suggest from the outset of the book, really, that the state's involvement in sports, and I'm quoting you here again, serves as a prism through which to investigate the larger history of France. And there are a number of ways in which you do this throughout the book that I'm going to want to come back to. But I just wonder if you could say a few words about how you see that working in general throughout the book, the sort of interaction between the history of sport in the period that you're looking at and the bigger context of the history of France, you know, that you are both a historian of sport and a historian of France, mm-hmm. and how you kind of see that working together.
Yeah, no, certainly. I think, you know, the French state, especially the, you know, throughout, but in the Fifth Republic particularly, is very concerned with this idea of image and realigning itself as the Cold War is starting to get along. I mean, the rise of the Soviet Union and the United States as the two bipolar superpowers, and France recently decolonized after 1960, really trying to figure out what its place is in the international balance of power. And there is the recognition that this notion of soft power or gaining influence and cultural power through things such as literature, culture, the arts, gastronomy, that is seized upon as a way that France can, quote-unquote, compete in the new Cold War world. Sport is seen increasingly as an area in which to compete, but the problem for the Fifth Republic is, there are many problems, but first, that the largest thing they confront is that there is not, was not at the time, and perhaps we could still debate if it's changed, there's not an ingrained sports culture or athletic culture in France in the same way as there is in the United States or Great Britain or some other parts of the West. And so it was difficult to try to encourage more French to be sportively active than they would have hoped. This coincides with the 1960s and the rise of youth culture and leisure culture. And so certainly other endeavors that are really vying for the attention, time, and commitment of the French youth.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're looking at the state and sport more broadly in the book, Lindsay. Your focus is on soccer or football, mm-hmm. And basketball. And I think most people who might be listening would be aware that, you know, football or soccer is a big deal in France, but mm-hmm. basketball might come as more of a surprise. So I guess I wanted to ask you, you know, why basketball? And if you could say a little bit about the history of those two sports that you focus on, the longer term history of those two sports in France, mm-hmm. you know, when do the French start playing soccer or football? When do they start playing basketball? Where do these things come from? You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but just to give mm-hmm. us some of that kind of background to the introduction of these sports in France and the enthusiasm for them, especially mm-hmm. with basketball, where I think, you know, for some people that might come as a surprise.
Sure. Choosing football was the easy, no-brain solution. Right. It's the biggest, most popular sport in France and has been for quite some time. I think we need to make a distinction that while football has been the number one sport in France for many decades now, it is, in terms of the number of people who play the sport, in terms of the number of people who consume the sport, whether through going to games or watching on television, it still remains a bit stigmatized within French society. Hmm. And getting into a little bit of the history of football in France will help make that point a little bit clearer. When football first arrives in France, it comes through Great Britain. The sons of the elites and the bourgeoisie bring it back where they learned it at school. They're sent to Great Britain for, you know, the prep school and university. And so they brought the game back. Similarly, at the same time in the late 19th century, and this is probably about the 1870s, 1880s time frame area, we start to see more British engineers and tradesmen arrive on the shores of France. So you kind of have a dual-pronged introduction of the sport in France in the late 19th century, but it's very much, at the time, it's associated with the upper classes. During World War I, the sport democratizes, everyone plays it at the trenches. And it's in the 1920s where the sport really starts to gain popularity. It becomes a sport of the masses. Many, particularly in the northern part of France, where a lot of the mines and industry is located, companies viewed football as a really great way to create solidarity around the mine or the company, and started creating clubs. Many of the strongest clubs throughout time in France are located in the north, Lille, Lens. So it has a very rich football tradition. Football professionalizes in France in the 1930s, in the early 1930s. I think it's around the 1932 to 33 season. Mm-hmm. And there is a long conversation in France in terms of the merits of professional sport versus amateur sport. The idea that amateur sport is really the ideal, in the way of Pierre de Coubertin, and that to be paid to play sport professionally was somehow, it wasn't really meeting the ideals of the of sport. So the early professionalization of football, I think, did certainly have a stigma to the game. At this point, it's much more associated with the working classes, with the immigrant classes. And going forward after the 1930s, there is that stigma that remains, even to a certain extent today. Football culture in France doesn't really start to implement until the 1960s and 1970s, when a combination of different things start occurring. You start to see broadcasts of games on television, firstly, mm-hmm. the government channels, and finally in the 1980s with the liberalization of television control, much more widely through Canal Plus. So people are getting their football in different ways. But you also have the rise in the 60s and 70s of famous clubs like Sochaux and Saint-Étienne and Nantes, clubs that had very strong winning records, not just in France, but also on the European scene. And that also helps to implement a stronger football culture, if you will. But I think it's really starting in the 1980s with the Platini generation, this generation surrounding Michel mm-hmm. Platini, Gian Tigana, and so forth, who have several strong performances at the 1982 and then the 1986 World Cups, who win the 1984 European Championship. And a different set of players who win the 1984 Olympic tournament in Los Angeles. This starts to create excitement in France towards the game. I noticed also in the press that this is the period where there's many more newspaper inches in the general press devoted to the sport. Mm-hmm. And certainly the consecration of football in the 1990s with the Zidane generation that, is kind of the ultimate arrival of football in French consciousness. But it still remains somewhat stigmatized as a working class sport. It's still not as warmly embraced as other sports disciplines that have always been associated with the bourgeoisie, like tennis, for example. Everyone mm-hmm. goes gaga for the Roland Garros tournament, or cycling, or right. even rugby or basketball. So that's kind of perhaps a slightly longer explanation of the cultural background of football in France. But I decided I didn't want to focus only on football, that I wanted some type of, I wanted to compare and contrast it to another team sport to put right. it on a somewhat level playing field. And I chose basketball, mostly because I knew a little bit more about basketball than about rugby or handball, which are two of the more popular team sports in France. I know nothing about handball. I know it's a lovely game, but I do know nothing about it. And I thought, also from the American perspective, basketball would perhaps ring a little bit it would be easier perhaps for those here in the U.S. to understand the compare and contrast with basketball a little bit more, mm-hmm. as it is a sport we're much more familiar with. And as I found out, basketball, it's a popular team sport in France, but it is not number one. It is not number two. It's probably right now about number five or six, mm-hmm. In terms of popularity. But it, you know, it when it first was introduced to the United States in France in the early 1890s, France was the first European country to be introduced to basketball by YMCA instructors. And it was French coaches who helped to, you know, proselytize or spread the game in certain parts of Europe. The sport remained stigmatized in France in the early 20th century. It was seen as a sport, a Protestant sport, with its association with the YMCA. It was a sport that was always stronger in the more Protestant areas of France. And you know, the early 20th century, keep in mind, is a period of, you know, the religious infighting in France, Catholics versus Protestants and Jews and so forth, before the Emile Combes Law of 1905. So there was some stigma to basketball. The arrival of the American Doughboys during World War I helps to change that. Becomes more popularized. And in the 1920s and 1930s, the French basketball teams, international, do quite well. Basketball is introduced as an Olympic sport in 1936. The Olympics are, of course, interrupted by World War II, but at the first post-war Olympic Games held in London in 1948, the French win the silver medal. They do fairly well in the 1950s, but go on a downhill slide thereafter. So basketball, it kind of fell off the radar in France for a while. And it was not until the mid to late 1970s and early 1980s that it began to be revived a little bit. It was still played, but it was seen by many French youth as an old person's sport, or something of the elite. Was never perhaps as fully embraced in youth culture. But that began to change in the 1970s and 80s, and certainly for a number of reasons, which we'll probably ask more about. But certainly the 1992 Barcelona Games with the U.S. Dream Team, who the French knew very well by that point, thanks to broadcast of NBA games in France during the 1980s. The 92 Olympics really mark the arrival of basketball more fully in French consciousness. And there's been a revival of the sport within France since 2007. France has been the number one supplier of international players in the NBA in terms of most number of players. So it's continuously for the past seven seasons. The San Antonio Spurs won the NBA Finals last night with two Frenchmen prominently on the roster, Tony Parker and Boris Diaw. So there's really kind of been a gradual uphill battle fought by French basketball. And there's a lot of really interesting comparisons between French basketball and football, which I think will probably be my next project.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah, no, this is a whole history that I had no clue about. So it was really interesting to learn about this. I mean, there was so much about football that I didn't know about that I learned from the book, but especially this history of this hidden history of French basketball that I hadn't been aware of. Lindsay, you talked about a few moments ago, you talked about this notion of the soft power and the ways in which sport functions as a sort of route to soft power, a kind of cultural power that mm-hmm. France seeks and gains and loses over the course of the history that you're examining. Another thing that comes up a number of times in the book at different moments, key moments, including the beginning of the period that you're looking at, the sort of period of the late 50s, early 60s, is this notion of a sports crisis. And the book begins, you know, with this idea, looking at the significance of the Rome Olympics in 1960 as a turning point. And then you discuss another a few other key moments of crisis throughout this period from 1958 to 2010. So I just wonder if you could tell us, you know, what's a sports crisis, and what are some of the significant moments of sports crisis that you talk about the book? Well, maybe just, you know, start with this one in 1960. Why was the Rome Olympics, how did it lead to a sports crisis for France?
The first sports crisis was really a crisis over wins and losses, or rather lack of wins, lack of victories, in that continuously failing to clinch key titles or key competitions, or placing 25th at the Rome Olympic Games, does not really help to portray a vibrant, rejuvenated, recharged France in the way that President de Gaulle really wanted to do in the 1960s. And there is reference in the archival material itself to sports crisis, as cruise de sport, the fact that they couldn't win. The Rome Olympics really kicked it off. The Rome Olympics were the first Olympic Games to be, I guess, quote unquote, modern in terms of media attention towards them. The first really kind of live broadcast on the larger scale. And several scholars and journalists have written about this particular Olympic Games. But what it did was it just magnified the poor French results. The French government by the mid-1950s was very well aware that sport was a really great way to portray this soft power. And they realized that they didn't have that much time to prepare for the 1960 Games, but gave directives to invest as much money in trying to obtain results and to allow athletes to train and obtain results for key sports that they felt were prestige sports, swimming, track and field. But they also denoted that money should be invested in fencing and basketball as the most cerebral of individual and then team sports, and thus those best suited for the French psyche. So in other words, the ones they felt that they should most easily excel in. And then, of course, this doesn't exactly happen at the Rome Games or thereafter. So it's kind of accumulation of continual losses or continual, quote-unquote, humiliations at the international sports level, whether it's the Olympics, whether it's the fact that the men's basketball team fails to qualify for major tournaments for a very long time. Same with the men's football team. The absence of having a French presence in competition when everyone else has. That was seen as contradictory to the image that de Gaulle was trying to portray. So the sports crisis, particularly the 1960 Games and the poor French finish, really kind of kicks off a governmental investigation in terms of what exactly is wrong within France, where they failed to produce quote-unquote winners, and how to go about fixing that. And they denote several key aspects: the lack of a ingrained sports culture, the fact that the youth are trying to do wanting to do other things like listen to rock and roll, or be delinquent or whatever have you. The absence of enough sporting terrains or sports facilities for people to play or to train in. And then also this aspect about not have the elite athletes of France not having the time or ability to train more full time. So at that point in time, those who competed for France internationally, whether it was in fencing, basketball, or wherever had you, they typically had full time jobs. They still had to provide for their families or for themselves, and then they would train for their sport on their own time after work or on the weekends. Keep in mind, this is in an era where you have a lot of athletes being produced in the United States through the university system, private sponsorship. But you also have many of the Eastern Bloc countries arriving with athletes who have been pretty much supplemented fully by the state. So it was felt very much that in order to help improve French athletic results, there had to be financial provisions for French elite athletes to be able to devote time to training and improving. And this is a really thorny debate, the issue of providing state subsidies to elite athletes who compete for France. Mm-hmm. Getting back to that notion I talked about earlier about idealism of amateurism versus professionalism,
right,
and being paid. Is that the first sports crisis? And it leads the government to implement several different changes, but mostly the first sports legislation in 1975 that spells out that sport is part of French culture. Attention should,
right,
be devoted to it. And the establishment of a series of youth sports training programs. So that's kind of the immediate first sports crisis. The second sports crisis I delineate is starting in the 2000s. And
right,
that's less, I think, about winning versus losing. I think it's more caught up in this greater question of what does it mean to be France in a post-colonial world?
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at a lot of the crises surrounding French sport in the 2000s, even 4 years ago, it really is centering over who is French or what it means to be French, and less over, you know, oh my God, we haven't won. What can we do to change this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm going to want to come back to those issues of the sort of more recent history of sport, well, especially football, but mm-hmm, of sport in France, and you know how that connects to the present day. The history of sports in France that you explore, Lindsay, in the book, you know, also converges with the history of the post-war period, and we've already talked a little bit about how that happens. And I just wanted to ask you about a few things, you know, key historic shifts in the post-war period that people may have read about or thought about with respect to other issues, not necessarily with respect to sport. And there are a few that you explore in the book that I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit more to the mm-hmm. connections between them. So that's the connection between the history of sports in France and, you know, the baby boom, the sort of demographic transformation of the post-war period, the connection of sport to the Cold War, the connection of sport to 68, and then I guess something you just touched on a moment ago with respect to Frenchness, the idea of the history of decolonization in the post-war period. So just pick and choose whatever you want to give us an example of how sports, the history of sports in this period that you're talking about, connects to these other bigger forces and changes in post-war French society.
Wow, that's a big list. Well, why don't I try chomping at the bit on this notion of sports vis-a-vis the baby boom generation, because I think that helps to kind of lay a lot of the context. In the book, I talk about how the baby boom, you know, it's seen as a crisis. It's a veritable youth crisis. They have so many youngsters that they've run out of space in the schools and the universities. It's enough to propel consumer production, which is a good thing at the time. But then there's also this question of what are all these youths doing when they're not at school or at home with their parents? And the French school day was traditionally very long, so it's not that there was tons of time, but increasingly in the 1960s, there's this notion of leisure time activities, hanging out with friends, listening to rock and roll, going to concerts, emulating some of these rock and roll stars, whether they're American, British, or otherwise. There was very much a fear in the 50s and 60s of a rise of juvenile delinquency, mm-hmm. which I don't know if that was actually really a threat, but it's a concern throughout Western societies of the post-war world, the fact that, you know, for the first time we have large numbers of youths who are relatively unsupervised for parts of the day and weekends, and what are they doing? Are they getting into trouble or not? Are they doing drugs, having sex, listening to rock and roll? This is the downturn of society. So sports are seen as a, and I'm talking about sports here, not physical education, but sports as after school, leisure time activities are viewed increasingly by French policymakers and perhaps many parents as a very good way for their youth, for their kids to have structured leisure time, supervised leisure time. It keeps them out of trouble. If you're playing sports on the field, you're less likely to be getting up to whatever you might otherwise be getting up to if you're just hanging out with your friends. So it's seen as a good way to help introduce supervised leisure time activities. And of course, sports teach certain things that are ideal in a democracy, such as fair play, playing by the rules, working together as a team, teamwork. This idea that it helps to promote democracy. So these were all perceived benefits of engaging in sports. I think as the baby boom generation comes of age and when we start to hit 68, mm-hmm. That kind of changes sports a little bit. They're a very politicized generation, and the book talks a little bit about how 68 impacts notably football and sports. But also, it's after 68 that the government starts to reassess just how strongly it may or may not wish to push sports. You can have more young people playing sports in their downtime, then perhaps that might be a way for them to work off steam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the fascinating connections you explore sort of throughout the book, but particularly in those sections where you're talking about, television, is this connection between sport and media in France and French history in the post-war period. And you show how both sport and television were liberalized. You talk about them being liberalized in the 1980s, and you mentioned this a few moments ago, and I wonder if you could say a little bit more about what happens in the 1980s with respect to television in France that is informed by and affects what happens in sport in the same period. There seems to be a kind of converging history there in the sort of early to mid 80s. And I'd like to hear more about that.
Well, certainly. Up until 1984, the French government controlled all of the three television stations in France. 1984, that changes. They relax the laws. We have the first private paid subscription television station arriving, Canal Plus, where they focus on broadcasting movies and sports, whether it's French sports, other European sports, or as I mentioned earlier, the NBA games, NFL games from the United States. And so it forces a liberalization of television. It forces the remaining government-controlled television stations to do more sports broadcasting, because that is, that's where Canal Plus is making a lot of their money. Mm-hmm. And so that starts to be kind of this crescendo of broadcasting of sports, kind of the consumerization of sports as perhaps a very good starting point for it in the modern period. In terms of how that intersects with the government sports policies, in 1984, there's another sports law that is passed that in part tries to work to liberalize the sports structure, so tries to work more hand in hand with private sports clubs and organizations in terms of finding, detecting, and providing opportunities for young players. So very much liberalizing a little bit more in terms of public-private partnerships.
Mm-hmm. At a number of different points in the book, Lindsay, you talk about women's sports and women's sports teams. I mean, they come mm-hmm. into the story here. But I think when we think of the history of sport, we tend to think of that as a history of men and masculinity. And I'm just wondering how you worked through some of those issues in the book, and how you think of the book as a contribution to a history of French gender relations, to masculinity in particular, and the roles that women and men, as women and men, play in the story here.
Right. Well, to be quite frank, I made a conscious decision not to focus on women's sport for this book, mostly because the information at the time I was doing my dissertation research, it was just too difficult to get at, mm-hmm. and I didn't have the time. So I had to put parameters. So that's why the focus is on men's sport. And when I had the information, I tried as much as possible to bring in that part of the equation mm-hmm. for how women's sports were functioning or compared to it. But certainly I'm not claiming that this book tackles it sufficiently in any way. And I think that there's an important, that's a field that needs to be developed very much so. That's kind of my blanket statement on women's sport in France. It's there, but someone needs to do some good work on it. One of the reasons I tried to include women's sport in the book where I had the information was that I think it's an area that needs further exploring, but I think it is part of a larger equation. I don't think it should be necessarily segregated out into its own, you know, isolated area. So I guess trying to, you know, just point out that while I don't have sufficient information to fully tackle it, here is what was happening in that field. It's part of this larger equation, part of the broader context of sport in France. Typically, football is not looked at as a feminine sport at all. And this has started to change, actually, since the early 1990s. In the past 10 or 15 years, the French Football Federation and FIFA, more generally, have been really concentrating efforts on promoting the women's game in France, as well as elsewhere around the world. And we do see, I mean, today you have a generation of female football players for France who are really quite good. The last Women's World Cup, they were, I think, in the top four, I believe, at the tournament's end, if my memory serves correctly. In France, there is a professional women's league that is tied to the men's league. But certainly fields enough to play. And some American female players have played professionally in France. So that's certainly something that's changed significantly.
Sure. I want to come back to the sort of thematic and other kinds of arguments you're making in the book, but something you mentioned just now about, you know, what you had information on for this particular project and where there needs, you know, where more work needs to be done. I wanted to ask you at some point while we're talking today about your research and your archival sources and also these interviews that, you know, the different kind of methodology that went into making the book. So it's going to take us away a little bit from the organization of the chapters and everything, but I'd love to hear you say more about, you know, how you got the information and the archival material for this book, and where who you spoke to, and how that kind of fit together with the written record that you're drawing on for this study.
Yeah, certainly. So the problem with writing any type of more recent history is access to sources, right? In France, the Ministry of Youth and Sport records are closed for 30 years. Which, you know, it's the same rough time frame that U.S. government archives are closed for, 25 or 30 years. I think it's now 25 before they're open to the public. So that meant, you know, and I was doing my research also almost, you know, 7-10 years ago now. That meant at the time I had access to everything up through the late 1970s. And that left me a problem with, well, you know, how do I, you know, if I can see written government documentation for the 50s, 60s, and 70s, what am I going to do for the 80s, 90s, and thereafter? And that's why a lot of my textual material that I consulted was also heavily drawn from newspaper archives. I looked at major national dailies such as Le Monde, Le Figaro, Libération, but also I did look at the French press, France Football, which is a weekly, I think now, football specific magazine, and also L'Équipe, which is the nation's daily sports newspaper. The press accounts, I used them throughout the period I was looking for, but starting after 1980, they played a much more important role simply because I didn't have anything from the government archives to cover that. And that's also why the latter sections of the book rely more on oral histories, interviews, than the first section of the book. And those I really kind of lucked out on. I just started writing blindly to different people and telling them, I'm working on this general topic. It's difficult to get information for this time period. I was wondering if you could, or someone you know could speak with me further about it. And, you know, a lot of times these were people who had lived through the era, who had observed it, and there is always a little bit of caution with oral history in that it is through the eyes of the beholder, but it helped to fill in the very large gap that I had.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is the book is kind of a great combination of those different types of sources. And so I think it, you know, just as a study in historical methodology, it's interesting. In the later chapters of the book, Lindsay, you talk about a sports renaissance of the 1990s and then another crisis that you referred to a little while ago in the period after this peak moment of, you know, the 1998 World Cup championship and the 2000 European championships and the other wins that you talked about at the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, but then things sort of taking a turn for the worse after this. And I just wonder, with the renaissance of the 1990s, you know, what accounted for this? Why did sports take off again or in a new way in France in the 1990s? How did we get to the 1998 World Cup? And then, you know, I guess one way of asking the question is what happened? What went wrong after that, if something did go wrong?
Oh, it brings tears to my eyes. I think what you start to see by the 1990s is part of this larger globalization of sports, larger consumerization of sports, that, you know, there's also significantly an increased sports media by the 1990s, late 1990s, early 2000s, that really help to permeate or saturate daily conversation or daily news with sports coverage, whether it's through television, in print, or in the internet. So I think that helps a lot, general globalization. That helps to explain why you see the rise of perhaps a sporting France, if not necessarily a sports culture, per se, in France. But certainly the French winning the bid to host the 1998 World Cup, that lit a fire under the feet of the French. They had to ensure that everything was ready stadium-wise, and certainly it was going to shine a spotlight on the country. The French Football Federation in the 1980s had tinkered a little bit with their youth development system in a way that began to produce players like Cantona and the Zidanes and Thurams and so forth, who have started to come of age in the early to mid-1990s. So that also helps as well. You just have a rise of a generation who is at their peak. In the 1990s, the French youth development system for football is known as one of the best ones around. And certainly the World Cup win in 1998, the European Championship win in 2000, the Confederations Cup win right shortly thereafter, really helped to cement that concept. You have major clubs in the biggest, the elite football leagues in Europe, actively paying large money for young French-trained players. And so that kind of feeds into a rise of sports in the 1990s. In terms of basketball, certainly you have a generation of young French kids who are influenced by, you know, Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan at the 1992 Olympics. And it's interesting. I've recently been doing research more on the basketball side. And so this is not in the book, but you start to see kind of this emergence in some of the sports press of kind of a, you know, basketball of the playground. So a looser, more prevalent form of basketball, less the older stodgy part. So it become basketball and NBA hip hop culture become more ingrained in French youth in the 1990s than perhaps had been previously. So that helps to explain, I guess, a little bit of that side of the increase.
Right.
And then what happened? Well, there's a lot of things that feed into the what happened question. And I think a lot of it is explained by the fact that in football, Les Bleus ceased winning. At the 2002 World Cup, they did horrifically. They exited after the group stage, and here they were, the reigning champions. And so I think that opened up the team for criticism. Whereas beforehand, as long as you're winning and great, you're untouchable. And so I think starting in 2002, you see an escalation of various factors that feed into the what happened question. But I certainly think that lack of a winning record, lack of legitimate, maybe not the right word, sportsmanlike wins, start to build up. We remember France was in the World Cup final in 2006 against Italy, and Zidane gets kicked out and ejected at the very end because he headbutts the Italian guy. That was seen as very unsportsmanlike, as much as people love Zidane. You know, the fact that the French barely qualified in November 2009 for the South Africa World Cup, and that one of the goals that helped them qualify was a handball from Thierry Henry. You know, that did not sit very well. So there was a whole combination of factors that started to feed into the what went wrong in 2010 when they spectacularly self-destructed at the South Africa World Cup. There was a lot of inter-squad fighting. There was a lot of tensions between players and the coach, between players and the technical staff. There were a lot of, I think, egos, perhaps, on the team that did not work as harmoniously as they could have. Accusations in the French press were that this was a collection of players who were, you know, what were the headlines? Individualistic PlayStation junkies who were interested in themselves and not the nation. I'm not sure exactly if that is the case, but that is what was going around in the media at the time. And then certainly the French did not play well in South Africa, and they staged the notorious strike during their last training session before their last game. And that going on strike certainly really kind of caused a huge bloodbath for the team in the French press, and helped to create this very toxic relationship between the French public and the team. But I really kind of find it curious that the public was accusing the team of not being, you know, French and representing the nation when, and maybe this is a bit cliche, but you know, we typically think that it's a French thing to do to go on strike. So there is that as well, but yeah, that's what happened. And since 2010, I know that there have been many attempts made at a variety of different levels in the media, in the French Football Federation, government, and the public to rectify a lot of the what went wrong. And so that's why this World Cup is so interesting. Everyone's watching Les Bleus much more. Much more closely, I think, than they would have if they had just had a bad tournament, as they did in 2002. I just came back from some time in France this spring, and it was remarkable that there is very much kind of a sense of optimism and hope surrounding the team, and there's the sense that people, they want the team to do well because they hope that they can realize this, that they can prove that 2010 was just, I refer to it as the 0 hour of French football, but that it was an aberration, that corrective measures have been taken, and that's not really that things have changed significantly. But I think there's also a sense of pessimism too, where the people are cautious about being too optimistic and waiting for the other shoe to drop. Perhaps that seemed to be kind of the two different main sentiments I was picking up on.
Well, I wonder about it because, you know, as someone who doesn't know very much about sports history per se, but who, especially my teaching, you know, I use the example of the World Cup victory, but also recent, you know, some of the debates and scandals around the team and the ways that people in the media or political figures talk about the French national team as a kind of way to tell stories. To tell a story or to look at debates and issues around, as you said earlier, Frenchness, French national identity, the legacies of colonialism, issues around race and immigration and those kinds of conflicts that sports, especially football, has in the last, I don't know, decade and more, been a way for people to talk about, you know, crises around French national identity. Do you think that that's a neat fit? Do you think it's opportunism on the part of the politicians and the media that do that? That story of a rise and fall, does it say, is it a story of, you know, debates around assimilation and secularism? Like, can you see that reflected in the world of football, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it's much more complicated than that. A lot of the field work I've done since the book came out really kind of helps to emphasize that it's much more complicated. I think that it is a space to talk about national identity and Frenchness, but I think it also has to be tempered with the, you know, what has been the traditional role and place and perception of football in France, that, you know, while it's always been the most popular sport, it has never been looked on as the nation's sport in quite the same way. So I think that's important to keep in mind, but also that French football has this very long tradition of assimilation, of helping to create Frenchmen. That, I mean, there have been generations of French footballers, Caucasian, Black, North African, everything in between, who really helped to create the legend of French football, and, you know, who continue to do so today. I think it is a form for that, but I think that it's much, much more complicated than people typically make out, certainly mm-hmm. in the press. But I think also within the academic circles, the lack of understanding fully the cultural place of the sport, and thus why it might elicit, you know, when French people critique football these days, it's not typically not about race or identity. It's much more about the culture and players acting in French, or an anti-football backlash, as I've started calling it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, Lindsay, I was so excited. I mean, we're recording on, what is it, Monday, June 16th? Is that what today is? I think the podcast is going to go up a few days after this, probably. But it was very exciting for me, you know, to watch. I'm a sort of very fair weather fan, but it was exciting to watch France, you know, victorious yesterday against Honduras, and to be able to talk to you today on an up note with a little bit of optimism myself. So I have to ask you, what do you think France's chances look like this round in this 2014 World Cup in Brazil? Are you a gambling person? Can you predict anything? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I'm in a bracket. World Cup bracket that is non-monetary, so it's just for bragging rights. But so the bracketologist in me wants France to go all the way and win the final, mostly because I had to pick that. Everyone else picked Argentina or Brazil, and, you know, you have to go against the grain sometimes.
Sure.
But I think that and, you know, I'm also not a technical expert on the game. I come to sports more from the cultural side rather than the box score, who has the biggest stats, that angle of it. But, you know, I have been watching very closely the last several games that Les Bleus have played, both the tune-up games that started at the end of May and into early June, and then certainly yesterday's game. And, you know, I feel fairly optimistic as long as they can keep up their confidence, they can keep up their momentum. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I talked to a lot of people when I was in France this spring, including many who are at the stadium, the Stade de France in Saint-Denis, during the last of the playoff games against Ukraine in November, the qualifying berth for the World Cup. And those who were there said something happened that night, both in the stadium and in the press. The French were fully supportive of Les Bleus. They were fully behind the team. The level of supportership and fandom that was exhibited on that night emphasized to the players that the nation was once again behind them. And, I mean, they've told me various variations of this, but effectively to the point that something changed, and also psychologically within these players, that having that confidence, not just that they could technically be good on the ground, but that the confidence that everyone is behind them, I think that, you know, that helps to explain a lot. So they can keep that up.
Mm-hmm.
If they can rise above the heat. And I think actually their prognosis is very good. I think that they will likely leave the group stage, and hopefully I will not prove myself wrong after this week. and then we'll see.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. Well, Lindsay, I've taken up a lot of your time, but I do have one last question that you kind of hinted at a little while ago, which is, you know, what are you working on now? What's the next project?
Once the World Cup is done, I'm going to turn my attention back to basketball. I've been trying to pull together some research for what I'm calling the revolution in French basketball, which we alluded to earlier, starting in the mid to late 70s, and, you know, how it was kind of went through various different phases, first spurred by the French government and the French Basketball Federation, the fact that we need to have taller players to compete internationally at basketball, a sport that we should be good at, realizing that sports medicine alone, trying to provide better nutrition for French players, didn't always work. Going into a period in the 1970s into the early 1980s of using natural Americans who naturalized and became Frenchmen to play for France and we blew in international competitions, and then kind of feeding into efforts to detect and train basketball talent amongst parts of the population that tend to be genetically taller or where there is a stronger basketball culture or influence. And that seems to have been in the Antilles in Guadeloupe and Martinique. So, and if you look at the players of the national team, the EDF, as they call it, shorthand, for basketball, they do, the ones who won the European Championship for the first time ever this past fall, they are very much the products of these kind of different waves. Tony Parker, who, his father was African-American, his mother, I think, Dutch, at the top of my head. But certainly growing up in France, but being influenced by his father's love for the game that he picked up in the United States. Other players from the Antilles, such as the Pietras brothers, Flo and Mikael, very much growing up in a part of the French overseas territories that typically have more exposure to American cultural ideals. So basketball kind of helping to shore that up. So that's a little bit about what I'm working on next.
Well, that sounds really fascinating, and I hope I get a chance to talk to you about it. I just want to thank you, Lindsay, for writing this really interesting book and for taking time away from the World Cup and your job to talk to me about it today.
Great. Thanks. Well, I appreciate the chance to talk about it. We've had some great conversations.
Yeah. Thanks very much. You've been listening to New Books in French Studies. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us again next time.